Welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And happy birthday to Michael G., who is all suited up and wearing a tie and ready for a hot night in the town. Happy birthday, Michael. We're just months apart in age, and we're just commiserating about what it feels like to be 57. Anyway, enough personal chit-chat. Get down to business. First, in a few minutes, we'll be speaking with David K. Johnston, who is a longtime tax reporter for The New York Times, who is now teaching at Syracuse University Law School and writing articles for tax journals and such. We'll talk to him about a couple of things. First, the tax experts' angle on Joseph Stack, the fellow who flew his airplane into the IRS building in Austin, Texas, a few weeks ago. And we'll ask him what it was in the tax code that sent that man into his murderous mission. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll listen to an interview recorded earlier in the week with Yanis Varoufakis, who is an economist who teaches at the University of Athens, about the Greek crisis. Why is Greece in an economic crisis, and why is the rest of the world so worried about it? Before all that, some words on the economic news. It has been a while, but at least in the economic world, not all that much has changed. The U.S. economy still limps along, trying to recover, but never in a very convincing way. The job market is stabilizing, and it has been for months, but not really turning around. Same thing for the consumer side of the economy. People are buying, but not all that much. As I've been saying here since the economic crisis broke out in the summer of 2007, the U.S. economy is caught in the horns of a dilemma, a very sharp set of horns. Here it is in radio shorthand. The economy was, from the point of view of its owners and rulers, suffering a very serious crisis of profitability in the 1970s. In the political realm, the ruling class felt like it was losing control of things. Workers were sullen and misbehaving, and the Third World was in outright rebellion. At the end of the decade, the bourgeoisie launched a successful class war from above. That assault, wage cutting, speed up, deregulation, outsourcing, union busting, cutbacks in the welfare state, all the familiar stuff gathered under the name of neoliberalism, created a problem for a system dependent on high levels of mass consumption, both to maintain aggregate demand and to secure its political legitimacy. Why put up with all the volatility and stress of American life if there's no promise of plentiful gadgetry and upward mobility? So the answer was to counter the downdraft of falling wages with rising borrowing via credit cards and mortgages. That model seemed to hit a wall in the recent economic crisis, but there's really no new model for accumulation. To forestall total collapse, the Obama administration passed a large stimulus program almost immediately on taking office. Though hardly perfect, it did succeed in putting a floor under the economy. And there's little doubt that what stabilization we've seen has come from that stimulus program and other government action, like the furious pumping by the Federal Reserve. But these things can't go on forever. Now the buzzword around among the pundits is the exit strategy. How can they withdraw all the stimulus without sending the economy down the chute? For the right, this isn't really a problem. They don't believe that the stimulus saved the economy and think that withdrawing stimulus would be an unmixed blessing. This is crazy and wrong. But that doesn't mean that huge deficits aren't a problem. A government can't borrow forever, even the U.S. government. It will ultimately be at the mercy of its creditors, and until they shut off the credit taps, they'll be taking more and more pounds of flesh in the form of interest payments. But the deficit could easily be reduced, even eliminated, by paring back the military, taxing the rich, and introducing a single-payer health care system. Needless to say, these are not likely to happen. Instead, we're almost certain to see growing pressure to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, a strategy on which the president recently declared himself agnostic, which is probably a synonym for receptive. Over the longer term, we need a new motor of economic growth. I've argued that clean energy and other green technologies could be that motor, and the Obama gang has made similar noises. But if you look at Obama's budget proposals, you'll see that he's not putting our money where his mouth is. That budget, unleashed in the world on February 1st, is a rather depressing thing. In many ways, it's reminiscent of Bill Clinton's budgets, filled with high-flown rhetoric in the prose portions about investment in the future, but without any actual numbers to support it. True to that model, Obama's budget message intones the need not only for clean energy, but also for education and all the other accoutrements of the future. But when you look at his proposed spending, you get bupkis. Overall, the fiscal effect of the budget will turn strongly contractionary as the stimulus program wanes as this year goes on. Spending will fall and taxes will rise. With the economy barely off its back, this is bad news. But things are discouraging even at the level of fine detail. For example, energy conservation, which is supposedly a major priority of the Obama administration. But on that, he proposes to spend 0.01% of GDP over the next 5 fiscal years, which is no change from what Bush actually spent. On general science and basic research, also accoutrements of the future, 0.08% of GDP, about the same as Bush. Pollution control and abatement, 0.05%, the same as Bush. R&D projections only go out a year, not 4 or 5, but on that, Obama proposes to increase civilian R&D from 0.38% of GDP to 0.44%. Energy R&D would double, alas, that's from 0.01 to 0.02% of GDP. Another big initiative, he'd raise federal spending on higher ed from 0.16% to 0.26%. Add together a few tenth of a point proposals, and you've got a real transformative agenda, eh? Yeah, there's Congress to contend with, but you'll never get anywhere if you don't even try. We're screwed. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk taxes.
Get off my back! So close, so far away. Sound bending, so you say. They got a bitch on me. And in this space society, I'm not looking for compensation.
And that's some of Blood, Death, and Taxes by Agnostic Front, Local Boys Made Good, from their 1999 album Riot, Riot, Upstart. And now we're joined by David K. Johnston, who was a longtime reporter on taxes for the New York Times and now teaches the Syracuse University School of Law, writes for tax journals, and is also the author of a couple of books on the tax system, Free Lunch and Perfectly Legal. Welcome to Behind the News, David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you, Doug, for having me.
Thanks for coming by. So let's start by talking about Joseph Stack, a fellow who flew his airplane into the IRS offices in Austin, Texas, a couple of weeks ago. What is the tax expert's angle on what he did?
Well, Stack cited a particular statute in the 1986 Tax Reform Act as his principal grievance. And while nothing justifies his criminal conduct and his murdering of Vernon Hunter and his effort to murder as many people as he could, his frustration does highlight a very serious problem in this country that gets very little attention, which is this continual passage of special interest laws that favor various individual corporations and wealthy people or industries and shift the burden of taxes off of them onto other people. In Mr. Stack's case, a law that was passed at the behest of IBM prevented him from getting work as an independent contractor. He's a computer programmer. Now, independent contractors can be used by big companies as a way to avoid paying benefits and to cheat people, but there are independent contractors, programmers who prefer to be independent contractors, believe they will keep their skills up better, and this law blocked them from doing that on the theory that they were tax cheats as a class and that the $60 million of extra taxes they'd be forced to pay as employees would finance a tax cut of $60 million for IBM.
Now, that's kind of strange why they singled out this particular profession, because there are plenty of independent contractors. And as you point out, a lot of the computer industry is staffed by independent contractors. So why this particular targeted piece of legislation?
Well, in the background of this, there were two competing organizations of what are called IT, information technology, IT job shops. These are brokers who found work for people, just like there are temporary help agencies for clerks and even accountants. One of part of the industry wanted people on an employment model where they were employees of the job brokerage. The other used the independent contractor model where they placed you in jobs, the way, say, a literary agent places your book. And the group that wanted to deal with the employment model had a common cause here with IBM, and these two issues came together. So this is another thing that goes on all the time in Washington and gets very, very little coverage. It is how Washington, which has become the central money-making concern for many industries in this country, there are industries that derive all their profits from various deals that they get out of Washington. Washington creates unlevel playing fields in return for campaign contributions that damage one sector against another, that grant favors to one group against another, and in the process make all of us worse off.
Well, it seems like it's a nice business for congresspeople to sort of sell themselves off or launch a bidding war for their legislative services.
Indeed, and this is the result of several other changes. One of them is the Supreme Court has taken the position that dollars are free speech in something called the Buckley case. And, of course, if dollars are free speech, then the wealthy in America who disproportionately have the money are going to have a disproportionate speech. Secondly, we have these gerrymandered districts. If you look at many congressional districts, there's no rhyme nor reason to their design except that a computer says this will make the district heavily D or heavily R. And that results often in people from extremes rather than the middle. And then finally, if you're a member of Congress, to run for office, or you're a senator especially to run for office, requires so much money now that your principal job is really raising money and courting favors with those people who want to support you. And it's interesting when you look at the gifts that somehow they just follow committees. You know, you don't see the maritime industry giving money to people who are working on the environment in the inner part of the country, and you don't see people on the health committee getting a lot of money from electric utilities.
Well, they're pretty targeted about their intentions, aren't they? So we strayed a bit from the IBM story, and Daniel Patrick Moynihan was doing a little legislative work on behalf of IBM, right?
Yes, this was Senator Moynihan acting on behalf of IBM, which is, after all, an enormous economic force in the state of New York. It's not unreasonable for him, even apart from any contributions, to be looking out for IBM's interests. But a year after this legislation was adopted in 1986, with no hearings, no public discussion, it just appeared late in the bill, Senator Moynihan realized he had made a mistake. Eventually, nearly 70 senators signed a letter saying this law should be repealed, and the signers included both Jesse Helms and Ted Kennedy, so it's not like this was a liberal, conservative, or Democrat-Republican issue. But the law has never been fixed, and it is one of thousands of laws like this that have been passed where there is no significant campaign contributions to be made from fixing it. Therefore, why fix it? Because it will cause you to not have revenue for something else you can sell as a favor.
Well, this is something that saved IBM a few bucks, but really put a whole bunch of people out of business, right?
Yes. Well, it put everybody who wanted to be a job shop broker on the independent contractor model, it put them at risk. I wrote in 1998 in the New York Times about someone who was put out of business by this. There are some firms that survived IRS audits. It didn't make it legally impossible to run such a business, but you ran the risk of an audit that not only would be expensive. In one case, a company spent 8 months in its audit. But if you lost an independent contractor audit, the penalties are so draconian they could easily put you out of business. So it became a very high-risk proposition. And about 90 major companies, including, by the way, IBM, said publicly after this law was passed that they would not hire independent contractors.
You alluded to this earlier, but a lot of folks in the software business, for example, are famous for hiring independent contractors to get around paying Social Security taxes. So how does this shake out? Why is independent contractors okay in some parts and not okay in others?
Well, that goes to a deeper issue, Doug, and that is those of us who are employees have our taxes withheld from our paycheck. And America has two income tax systems, separate and unequal. One is for employees who never even get to see the money that's due to the government and who, unless they take steps, will have more withheld than they need to pay at the end of the year. That's why you have all these people getting refunds. The other are business people, whether they're little individual computer programmers or multibillionaires, landlords and investors. Congress trusts them to independently report with no verification what their incomes are and does not require withholding for them. If we had withholding for independent contractors at levels proportionate to their profits, because when you're an independent contractor, everything is an income to you. You do have some expenses. But if we had withholding for independent contractors, there would be no issue. But the Republicans have made a decision that they will fight any effort, even those supported by small businesses, to have withholding of independent contractors and small businesses. So we don't have a sensible policy as a result, and that's because the Republicans have decided to make the most vile four-letter word in America, tax.
Well, this is a country that was founded on a tax rebellion, though, right? I was speaking with David.
Yes, although, Doug, a little historic point few people know. At the time of the American Revolution, people in England were paying, depending on how you analyze the numbers, 25 or 50 times per person what the colonists were paying in taxes. The colonists were living virtually tax-free and being subsidized by the mother country.
Well, that's the way we like it. I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, who a longtime reporter for The New York Times, now teaching at Syracuse University School of Law and columnist for Tax Notes and author of couple of books on the tax system, Free Lunch, and Perfectly Legal. You also have done some interesting work on what's going on at the top of the income distribution, the 400 richest taxpayers in the United States. How lightly or heavily are they getting taxed?
Very lightly, and their taxes are falling. And it's important that you use the right word there, taxpayers. The data we're going to talk about is not the 400 highest income Americans, because there are many people in this country who have enormous incomes and legally pay no income taxes. You can have multi-billion dollar incomes annually, every year, and legally pay zero income taxes.
That would include but a lot of those hedge fund dudes, right?
Hedge fund managers are one of them. They're allowed to defer. Corporate executives are allowed to defer, and many of them defer, people at the very top, defer the bulk of their income and don't pay the taxes immediately.
Forever, or do they have a day of reckoning somewhere down
the road? At the point that they get paid out, they are supposed to pay their taxes. But two things happen. One is some of them arrange to have their income converted into a fringe benefit, and most often a life insurance policy to their children. When they die, that life insurance can go, to, if it's set up right, tax-free to their children outside of both the estate tax and the income tax, and is never taxed, but the company gets a deduction.
These would be like Fortune 500 CEOs at this level?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. And then the other device is that, especially if you're offshore, the government does not really have good tracking mechanisms for this. So if you're a hedge fund manager, and even though the hedge fund is run in Manhattan or Greenwich, Connecticut, or San Francisco, legally it is offshore. I haven't seen any evidence that we have a serious method to make sure that when you cash in 30 years from now, we will know how many billions of dollars you have and make sure you pay your taxes.
So these 400 highest income taxpayers are actually a bit of chumps, actually, having to pay some taxes, aren't they?
Yes, exactly. Their average income, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say their average income is almost $350 million in 2007.
That's right. Almost $350 million each on average. That's just short of $1 million a day. One way to think about this is that in the first 40 minutes of 2007, these folks on average made the same amount of money as half of all the workers in America, because half of all jobs in America pay less than $509 a week. maybe I shouldn't say jobs, half of all people who work at a job make less than $509 a week, because some people hold two jobs to make that much. And they made that in about 40 minutes.
Pretty nice.
And yet they pay a lower tax rate than someone who makes, who's single and who makes $500 a week.
So these guys are paying a lower tax rate than their cleaners and secretaries are.
That's exactly right.
And how can this be? We supposedly have a progressive tax system, you know, although it's not, we've come a long way from when it was, the top rate was, at least on the law books, 90%, but it's still substantially
right.
Higher than that in law. How do they get away with it?
And remember that when it was 91% and it was supported by the sitting president of the United States, he was a Republican, Eisenhower. The way they get away with it is that Congress has been steadily cutting taxes on the richest Americans and raising taxes on everybody else when you count both income and payroll taxes. So that in 1993, when Bill Clinton was president, the tax rate for the then top 400 taxpayers was just under 30%. It's now down to 16.6%.
Now, this is the rate they pay. This is not the legal.
They actually pay.
Yeah.
This is the rate they actually pay, and it's just the income tax. When you add in their share of Social Security, it's nothing because Social Security cuts out at $108,000 currently.
So their first few minutes of work of the year, then they're finished with it.
That's exactly correct. And this tax rate cut is, I mean, phenomenal. That's almost half, to go from 30 down to 16.62. That's how big of a tax rate cut they've got. Now, the biggest part of that cut they got from Bill Clinton. Clinton cut their tax rate by 8 cents on the dollar in 1997 when he passed a bill lowering capital gains taxes. And then Bush had all these tax cuts, but all the Bush tax cuts together have only added about 6 cents to that. So if you're the super rich in America, your friend is actually more Bill Clinton than George W. Bush.
But I think the only thing they remember is that he raised their taxes early in his administration.
He raised taxes on people who have wage earners, who have earned income. So if you have job income, whether you're a movie star, a baseball player, an executive, president of your own company, you paid higher taxes. Lawyers, doctors, television personalities, higher taxes. But if you're a business owner, you got a and an investor, and your income is capital gains. That is, you bought something at one price and sold it at a higher price, whether it's stock or a whole company. You got this big cut from Clinton and a smaller cut from Bush, but together you've had a tremendous reduction. And Doug, if I can just take a second to give a little historical perspective to this.
Please do.
The top 400 report only goes back to 1992, but it turns out that in 1961, there were only 398 taxpayers who made $1 million. And so when you're looking at averages, that's a perfectly comparable set of numbers. So from 1961 to 2007, that's 46 years. That's an entire working career. You go to work at 20 and you retire at 66. Well, over that time period, the average after-tax income, including payroll taxes, of the bottom 90% of Americans grew by 30%. 46 years, and for every dollar you got back in 1961, you got $1.30 in your pocket in 2007. You hardly went anywhere in terms of your income.
That's less than 1%
people
a year growth.
That's exactly right. It's about 0.6% a year, and the economy grew a great deal more than that. The economy grew on average at about 3% a year. So the economy is growing five times faster than your after-tax income. And what about the people at the very top? For every dollar they had after tax in 1961, they had $36.50 in 2007. So their rate of increase was more than 120 times your rate of increase. And that's at the core of what's going on in our country. We have created a government redistribution system up.
Well, yeah, we had this enormous swelling of pre-tax income at the top. At the same time, the tax rate was coming down, so they're gaining coming and going.
That's right. The incomes of people at the top pre-tax have been growing as well, not quite as much. The difference, I'm doing this one from memory, but I think it's $27.70 to 50 cents after 47 years. So there's still an enormous variation. But the tax rates on most of us have gone up, and on the very top, they've come down. And so, plus, remember, this is the tax system's measure. It's not complete. If you're the CEO of a big company, you've got the company jet that you get to fly in for a tiny fraction of the cost of driving an automobile. It's much, much cheaper to use the company jet. You have all sorts of perks available to you, and your company often pays the taxes on your perks. So if they provide you with financial planning to help you manage your money, then they pay the taxes on the money they gave you to hire a financial planner. Ordinary Americans don't get this. And so what's happening is that government rules are redistributing the money and providing nearly all of the gains from all the economic progress we've made in the last half century to a very narrow slice. And it's almost all going to the top 1%, especially the top half of 1%. And the top half of 1% starts at about $600,000 a year of income.
All right, we've only got another couple of minutes left, but what about the political reaction to all this? The most palpable form of anger about this is coming from the folks wearing tea bags in their head. What do you think of their political critique of the tax system?
Well, I actually went to a Tea Party event to interview some of these people, and I've been writing about these folks of like them since the 60s when I started out as a reporter. They are incredibly inchoate in their understanding of what's happening. For starters, I asked at this event several different people, well, what do you think the Boston Tea Party was about? And they sort of hesitate, and one of them said at one point, well, it was about taxation without representation. I said, well, that was half of it, but you know what the other half was? They said, yes, it was a protest against high taxes. And I said, well, no, actually, it was a protest against a tax favor for the rich friends of King George. It was a tax exemption for them, combined with the creation of a monopoly on their behalf that would have raised prices and everybody else. And a guy standing next to me shouted, liar. And I said, well, sir, have you gone to London and read the documents? I mean, read the books that are the historic books written about this? I mean, I have. If you've read them, correct me and give me the sources that you relied upon. And, of course, he doesn't, you know this at all. And if you were to watch every day just broadcast shows that promote the stock market with softball questions to CEOs and to watch Fox News, you would get this totally jaundiced impression of what's going on in the tax system, and you would have no idea about how the gains from all the economic growth in America by government policy are not going to the vast majority of Americans. They are being funneled to those at the very top, the political donor class.
Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes, for example.
Exactly. Roger Ailes, who makes, what, $24 million a year running Fox.
Yeah, and Rupert Murdoch, who makes far more than that, no doubt.
Yes.
You also think that there's a certain degree of underlying reason to this class rage. It's just poorly understood and poorly expressed.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the fact is people's taxes have gone up, their incomes haven't gone up, and they don't understand what's happened to them. And this is a very important point. And I don't think that they're angry per se, and I don't think most Americans are about the riches at the top. I don't have anything against people being rich, but earn it in the marketplace and carry a reasonable burden for maintaining the rest of the society. Don't get a law passed that forces money out of my pocket to give to you, that takes away my liberty if I want to be an independent contractor, that restrains my business so that somebody else who made a bigger donation can do things I'm not allowed to do in my business. Earn it in the marketplace. Earn it. Don't do this through this corrupt welfare system for the super rich. And the teabag people recognize that they are not doing well economically. What they don't appreciate is how the system is doing this to them. They think it's the Democrats, and the Democrats have plenty of guilt here, and that their savior is lower taxes.
Well, they get lower taxes than them, but higher taxes than somebody else might be a better formula to think about.
Yes, but that's not the one they're thinking about. They just want lower taxes, less government. You know, one of the things, I can make you wealthier by raising your taxes, and I can make you poorer by lowering your taxes. In my neighborhood in Rochester, New York, where I live, my neighbors and I voted 4 years ago to raise our taxes. And for every additional dollar of tax that I pay, I have $1.40 more money in my pocket. Now, how could that be? Well, we used to all hire separate garbage companies to take away our trash, and every day of the week we had a different trash truck coming down the street to hit one or two houses. We created a trash collection district. It went to bid. A single company bid to get it, and each year their bid has gotten lower and lower because of the competitive pressures, so that now we spend 40 cents collectively for every dollar we used to spend as a group. We could be doing that with lots of things. We could be doing that with health care if we had single payer. That's what we do with socialized police, socialized fire departments, socialized prosecutors, socialized jails, socialized military.
All right, I'm afraid I got to bring it to an end there, but thank you for a very enlightening discussion. I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, former longtime reporter for the New York Times, now teaching at the Syracuse University School of Law, columnist for Tax Notes, and author of a couple of books, including Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. Okay, I don't really have time to take a formal station break, so I will do it myself. This is WBAI, New York, 99.5 in your FM dial, and on the web at WBAI.org. Thanks to all those of you who pledged during our recent fundraiser, and please don't forget to make good on your pledge, because the pledge is only as good as the envelope that follows up the pledge. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Greece. And that was some of Nshima by the Greek composer Ioannis Xenakis. And I just played that only because he's Greek. That's also because it's pretty good. All right. Speaking of Greeks, this interview with the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis was recorded earlier in the week. And I wanted to talk about what is going on with the Greek economy and the crisis it's thrown the country into and much of Europe and the rest of the world as well. Okay. Yanis Varoufakis. Welcome, Yanis. Your country is giving the world a headache. Tell us what's been happening.
My country is in the grip of a major, major crisis. The headache is all ours. But it seems to me that Greece is being used as the spear by which a particular turn following the 2008 crisis is going to affect the whole of the Eurozone to begin with.
All right, well, let's review some of the recent economic history of Greece. What's been happening? Has Greece been in recession with the rest of the world lately?
Well, look, Greece entered the Eurozone in 2000. On the run-up to 2000, Greece, in order to get into the Eurozone, did everything that was asked of it by the powers that be in Brussels, in the center of the European Union. And indeed, it achieved a major miracle in reducing inflation from 18% to 3%, pushing interest rates down, and thus managing to enter the club of the euro. It was a fragile economy, always had been, an economy which is in deficit, trade deficit with the rest of Europe. And to put it very bluntly, when the shock waves of the earthquake of 2008 hit Greece, because it was the weak link in Europe, it was the one to tumble first. There is no doubt that our governments, especially the one between 2000, 2004 and 2007, ran up a large fiscal deficit. So in that sense, you could say that Greece was in a precarious position due to its own fiscal irresponsibility. This is the line that is pushed by the Financial Times, by the Wall Street Journal, by Brussels and Frankfurt. The fact of the matter, however, is that the reasons why Greece Greece has landed in the mire in which it finds itself at the moment has very little to do with fiscal irresponsibility. And let me give you an example. Take Spain. Spain, up until 2008, was the blue-eyed boy or girl of the European Union, in the sense that it was actually running a surplus in the government budget. It had regulations for its banking sector that were far better and more stringent than anything that the United States, the United Kingdom, or France or Germany had managed. And yet, look at Spain now. Spain, even though it was doing everything right according to the prescriptions of the powers that be, isn't exactly the same situation as Greece is now. And indeed, if Spain blows up the way that Greece is blowing up, the repercussions are going to be much worse. So what's happening? I think what's happening is very simple. The Eurozone is a currency union. It's like the United States. The United States is a currency union. So, you know, New York and California and Ohio and North Carolina, you have the same currency. But if Ohio, for instance, is experiencing much slower growth than California, and if it has a trade deficit with the rest of the United States, no one in the United States is going to turn around and say, well, you know, this is too bad, get out of the union. Or you have to deal with your problems all by yourself. In the Eurozone, you've got a currency union, but no political union. So, to put it very simply, in 2008, we had a complete credit crunch worldwide. In the United States, we had the massive bailouts that you know better than I, so I don't need to delve into that. In the European Union, we did not. And we did not for a very simple reason. Germany and Holland, but mainly Germany, are primarily in control of the monetary policy in Frankfurt and regarding the euro. And they have a very simple policy for getting out of the crisis. Obama has the policy of using the Federal Reserve and the Treasury in order to inject as much cash into the economy as is necessary in order to keep the economy going. Germany is trying to get out of the crisis by exporting to the rest of the world. Now, up until 2008, Germany was exporting to the United States, to China, to Latin America. It had a trade surplus. Since then, because of the collapse in demand from your neck of the woods, from China and Latin America, the only countries with which Germany still enjoys trade surplus are countries in the Eurozone, like Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, and so on. And look, and this is the incongruity. They have this policy of not inflating their economy, unlike the United States and Britain, and trying to get out of the crisis by creating demand through exports. Exports to whom? To us. To the rest of the Eurozone. So they want to have a surplus, but they don't want us to have a deficit.
It also seems to be that there's a problem with the German strategy in that to be a proper hegemon, as the United States has been for the last 50, 60 years, you have to spend a little recklessly. You have to spread the money around and run deficits with the rest of the world to stabilize the system. Now, we may be running into the vital contradictions of that now, but that's, you know, 5 or 6 decades it's been fairly successful. Germany does not seem to be willing to step into that role. Is Germany just not up to the role of dominating the Eurozone the way the United States has been to the rest of the world?
I think you hit the nail right on the head. Germany has been, from the early 1950s up until 2008, let's say, it has been enjoying the fact that it was the United States that was, as the hegemon, as you said, creating the demand for the German surplus. In 2008, that story ended. I do not think that the political elite of Germany, and this is, I think, the tragedy of Europe at the moment. The problem is not countries like Greece or Spain or Portugal who are running a deficit. The problem of the Eurozone is Germany, because they have not understood exactly the point that you raised, that in order to maintain their leading position and their capacity to accumulate capital and to grow technologically and so on, they have to have demand for their goods. The United States knew this very well about Germany and supported German surplus creation for decades. As of 2008, that story has ended. Germany now thinks that it can get away, can get out of this crisis by pretending that there is no problem with regard to demand for its goods in places like Greece and places like France and Italy and so on and so forth. And they are hiding behind this neo-mercantilist mentality. I was talking to an officer of the ECB, the European Central Bank, who happened to be German. And of course, you know, that bank is in Frankfurt. It is nothing more than the extension of the old Bundesbank, the Central Bank of Germany. And I put exactly the point you raised to him. And I was astonished by the reaction. He said, you know what? You're right. What we're doing is probably going to push countries like yours into recession, into permanent recession. And I said, yes, but aren't you worried that this is going to stop us from buying your goods, buying your exports? And in a twist of quasi-intelligence, he said this to me. He said, well, we are pushing wage deflation towards you. We're forcing you effectively to reduce wages. But you know what? Wage earners in your country do not buy Mercedes-Benz. It is the elites of countries like yours who do. And we're going to look after them. We're going to ensure that there are transfers of European money, effectively German money, to Greece to build roads and metro stations and improve telecommunications. And the people who benefit from that are the elites and perhaps the migrants, migrant labor. Greek wage laborers, we don't care for, because in any case, they buy Chinese or Korean. So they might as well reduce their demand for imports into the Eurozone. I thought that was brilliant, but I thought that what was terrifying was so wrong. Because if we have a negative growth of around 5 to 8%, which is what I predict is going to happen next year, given the wage deflation that is being pushed down our throat at the moment, I think that the elites are going to find it very, very hard to maintain their demand for German products too. So my accusation for the Germans is that they're not that they're being selfish or misanthropic, but they are being a bit idiotic.
I'm surprised to compare the Greek accounts now with Argentina when it entered its crisis in the early 2000s. Argentina was actually running a large current account surplus and was roughly equal as a creditor-debtor on the world stage. Greece, by contrast, has an enormous current account deficit and is a very large foreign debtor. How is your country supposed to get out of this mess?
Well, to be blunt, I don't think we can. Not given the current circumstances. We have a debt of about 300 billion euros. It's much larger than the size of Greece. And we don't have what Argentina had in the 1990s. We do not have the capacity to deflate the size of this debt through an exchange rate adjustment. What happened in Southeast Asia, for instance, in the late 1990s, was there was a feeding frenzy by the markets, sort of bets being taken all over the place against the currencies of those countries. Those currencies collapsed. And that acted, to some extent, as a means by which South Korea, for instance, bounced back. We don't have this luxury anymore because we are part of a fixed exchange rate with the rest of Europe. Now, my hope, it's not a very strong hope. I'm not investing much on it, and I'm not betting on it. But anyway, it is my hope, nevertheless, that the inability of Greece to service its debt is eventually going to inform the powers that be in Europe that you can no longer run a currency union without some kind of mechanism by which to recycle the surpluses and the deficits around the place. It is quite absurd to think that you can have a country like Greece with a developmental drive which is much weaker than in Germany, locked to the German currency, without some kind of mechanism by which to recycle the German surpluses to places like Greece. I think that what needs to be done is that we have, as Europe now, as a united entity, to think of ways of redressing the problem of disproportionalities that economists have always known, at least progressive economists have always known.
I'm speaking with Yannis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. You know, this brings up what is almost the foundational problem of the whole Eurozone, which is that it brought together countries' economies that were at extremely different stages of development, very different productivity levels, different productivity growth rates, and you know, countries like Greece and Portugal in direct competition with a country like Germany, which is a very formidable competitor. Is this really the crisis of that whole model? Is the European Union, the whole, at least the monetary portion of it, about to break apart?
I think so. But let me put it in a historical context. The Eurozone, the Euro, is a creation effectively of two very important personalities in the European political scene. Helmut Kohl, the Chancellor of Germany, and François Mitterrand, the President of France. These two were quite far-reaching and full of foresight politicians, and they decided very, very simply that the way to create political unity in Europe was through economic unity. And you can't have economic unity if you have currency, different currencies and exchange rates fluctuating up and down. Maastricht, which was the agreement, the covenant, which brought European countries together as a prelude to the creation of the euro, as far as I'm concerned, was Helmut Kohl's and François Mitterrand's idea of a first step that needs to be created or taken before political unity, federation, is achieved. I think that these two men, even though I disagreed entirely with their politics, both of them, could see very well the point you're making, that you can't have monetary union without federation. But it was their project to create the currency union in order to allow a financial and economic crisis like today's to bring Europe, the peoples of Europe, actually the elites of Europe, up against a very simple dilemma. Either go for federation or disband the whole European Union idea altogether. So my hope is that now they will understand that, that Greece cannot be left to its own devices, and it's not a moral issue, but it is a very practical issue, that once you have unified the currencies, you have either to say, to admit that it was a bad idea, or to move to federation.
Well, it sounds like you're saying then that this crisis might not cause the European Union to fall apart, but in fact might lead it to its maturation.
Well, you know, it's happened before. Crisis, as someone said, I think it was Karl Marx, I'm not entirely sure, are great opportunities that should not be missed.
Well, Rahm Emanuel, Obama's top aide, also said you can't let a good crisis go to waste. So,
well, you know, good ideas percolate through history.
Now, what about different approaches to solving this problem? What about the possibility of Greece arranging some kind of orderly default and restructuring its debts that way?
Well, I think that this is an idea that should be taken very, very seriously. I mean, look, if I were Minister of Finance for the Greek government, and I'm very glad I'm not, but let's say that I were, just for argument's sake, in the European Ministers of Finance meeting at the ECOFIN, when the Germans and the Dutch are pointing the fingers at me saying, you've got to reduce your deficit, you have to cut down wages, and you have to reduce the size of the public sector and fire people and all that, I would turn back and say, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is this. I'm going to present you with a dilemma. We're going to cut spending. Where we can trim fat, we will do it, but we're not reducing wages and we're not reducing employment. And you have two options. Either guarantee our next issues of bonds. Okay, we don't want money from you, but we want you to ensure that we do not pay interest rates which are higher than the ones that Germany pays in order to service our debt. And if you're not prepared to do that, then I'm going to go to the IMF. And I'm going to file for bankruptcy. Because bankruptcy does not mean that the country gets bankrupt, it means that the state gets bankrupt. Now Greece, even though we have huge problems in terms of our public sector, well, in terms of our private sector, we're doing pretty well. In what sense? Our citizens have the lowest debt in Europe. This sounds strange, doesn't it? But Greeks do not have much debt. We have one-third of the debt of the French and one-eighth of the debt of the British as individuals. Greek companies have a very low proportion of debt. Greek banks are actually supported by the highest proportion of their own capital and savings in Europe. So if we go bankrupt, it will be the state that goes bankrupt. And if that happens, the IMF steps in, effectively we're going to have an arrangement, and we will repay, let's say, 70 cents to the dollar. To whom? To Goldman Sachs and all those people who were, on the one hand, lending money to the Greek state, while at the same time taking bets, you know, short-selling Greek bonds against the Greek state. So if I ask you for a loan of $1 million and I have no money and you give it to me, I'm the culprit, but so are you. So both of us have to pay for such a bad deal. And I don't see why the ones who lent the Greek governments of the past should expect to get their full capital back plus interest at a time when Greece is in the state it finds itself in.
In the few minutes we've got left, let's talk a little bit about the politics of this. There was a general strike about a week ago. It does seem like the Greek population is not quite as passive as the American population is. What are the possibilities of resistance to any kind of austerity program that gets imposed by Frankfurt or Brussels?
It's a very mixed picture, Doug. On the one hand, it is true that the Greek public, as you know, because we've talked before about the riots last December and the December before that in Athens, especially the youth, are completely disenchanted with the system and are quite prepared to resist on the streets very actively and very energetically, as you know. At the same time, I have to say that history has taught us, not only in Greece but everywhere, that the period of recession, of a savage recession, is not a good period for organizing mass struggle. The mid-war period proved that beyond a shadow of a doubt. The early 1980s in Britain proved that when unemployment is rising, you may have conflict, industrial conflict, even some good demonstrations, but that does not mean that society is resisting effectively. The other day we had a general strike here in Greece, and I can tell you that I marched with the unions, but I can testify that the general mood was one of resignation. It reminded me in a sad way of the demonstrations we had in 2003, just before the invasion of Iraq. You will recall that throughout Europe there were anti-war demonstrations before the war was launched in Iraq. I remember that we had 800,000 people in the center of Athens, and yet everybody believed that the invasion was going to take place and that we're not going to be able to prevent the massacre. That was the kind of feeling that I got the other day. We resist, we demonstrate, but it's a bit tokenistic.
So what do you see happening to the broad Greek population in the coming year?
I think we're entering a period of major recession, accelerating poverty, which is going to inflame the ultra-right and their attacks against migrants. I very much fear for the migrant population of Greece, which is about 10%, perhaps more, 10-15% of the total population here. And they're very recent migrants. And during a recession, the migrant community is always the one that bears the brunt of disorientated anger. I fear for the young people who are already experiencing a very high unemployment rate. It's not looking good. But as we said before, this crisis, because I think it's going to spread throughout Europe, it may bear smidgens of hope regarding the possibility of a pan-European reaction to the idiotic position that all you need to get out of a crisis is the stability of the currency and the elimination of the deficits. The Herbert Hoover syndrome, as I call it.
Well, when this crisis broke out, a lot of people, and I must say I found this tempting myself, thought of it as the beginning of the end of neoliberalism. Do you see anything like that happening in the coming years?
I'm afraid not. And you can see that in your own country. what's happening, I believe, in your own country is that now we have bailout money being used in order to support candidates and lobbyists arguing against the regulation. So the crisis by itself creates a window of opportunity. I do not believe it guarantees progressive change. Do you?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. That's the way it's, not the way it's turned out. But maybe we're just in the early phases of all this.
Yep. It's a bleak time.
And that was Yanis Varoufakis, who's a professor of economics at the University of Athens, talking about the economic crisis in Greece. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week. Let's go out with this. An antidote to bleakness. A rendition of the old jam song, Pretty Green, performed by Mark Ronson and Santigold. Till next week. Bye.